This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. As Martin Luther King Jr. Day approaches, community members in La Crosse are preparing for an annual celebration of the civil rights leader. Part of the festivities include a featured speaker, and this year that's David Dennis Sr., a retired attorney and activist from South Carolina. Dennis was a leader during the 1960s civil rights movement and after, working to empower African-American voters and improve their representation in politics. Joining us today to talk about his experiences and his message for the La Crosse community is David Dennis. Thank you so much for being here.
And how are you today?
Great. So the title of your lecture for this year's Martin Luther King Jr. celebration is What Does It Mean to Be an American? And I wonder if you could start us off by talking about how you hope to answer that question.
Well, that's the question that's been raised, especially under the new administration, and then looking at the evolution of the history of this country and in terms of how it's related to people of color. And so the question is where do you want? When we talk about make America great again, which really begin to raise that question, is what does that mean? For me, as an African-American, the past, my past experience in the past in American history, and my the roles that we played, you know, has not been what I consider to be great for me as part of a people. And so the question becomes, then, what is it that we want? So I looked at the 60s and the work that we did in the civil rights movement, people dying and going to jail and being beaten just to get the right to vote, or to sit at a lunch counter, to the right to public accommodations, the right to a first-class education, all came at a very, very high price. And so then we look at today, after all this in the past of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voters' Rights Act, and all the acts prior to that, and looking at where we are now, you know, I began to raise that question, you know, what type of America do we really want? Because if we're looking at the issues around the national anthem, and then I think about when we look at the Bill of Rights and we look at the preamble to the Constitution, and when it was written, what did it mean then to the writers? I mean, were we as a people, all of Americans and citizens really included? And when the preamble was written, when the original Constitution was formed, because at that time, as we as a people were not considered to be a total human being. And then when I look at the national anthem, even, and I look at that is, and I read the third verse of the national anthem, I hear there, I see and hear a support for slavery. And so when I begin to look at those things, as when people begin to talk about Make America Great Again, I had thought about in the 60s and the work that we did, maybe we had passed all of this, but then when you say Make America Great Again, does that mean going back to those times? Are we talking about something different and greater? And if so, is what are we trying to do about it? And so that's where the question comes from. You know, what does it mean to be an American citizen? What does it mean to be an American in this day and age?
Why do you think this reflection is so important as, you know, we head into a new year?
I mean, this is a very bad time, not for just any one type of people or group of people in this country, but as America as a whole. And the world is looking at us. I mean, the world has been watching us for a long time. And in the 60s, you know, it was the greatest time for this country to really model to the world what it means to be an American. And that is in the Freedom Summer and the challenge of the Democratic Party in the seating areas. And when this country said no, when you had thousands of students around the country, both black and white, joining hands together, fighting for democracy. And when they denied the seating of the Democratic Party, I mean, this country has not been the same in terms of people, young people, and people as a whole of all colors beginning to raise the question. So there's a question about the Vietnam War, and there's a question about, you know, where we were going as a people, as a group in this country. So to me is that that's caused another type of an awakening. And so here we are again is, as we pass through those times, is we back again is the reason the same questions and issues, really, whereby there's a blatant slap in the faces in terms of what I think that democracy ought to be and should be. So America, people have to make a decision here. So we at that crossroads. And this year we got to shut down based on the fact of putting up a wall to keep people out is one thing. Is, you know, that's a very critical issue and a question here is, I mean, in terms of what we're doing, what's the symbolic representation of such a wall? And so we have to begin to think about this in a very serious matter is because now we're talking about our children and others. You know, I'm looking at a time whereby, you know, you got President of the United States is who talks about grabbing women and the disrespect of women is, and, you know, and, you know, you can buy the privates and whatever you have is. And then looking at TV where mothers and grandmothers are wearing T-shirts with an arrow saying, grab this, Mr. Trump. You know, I mean, I'm like, what is going on here is, you know, I mean, the change and of being more blatant. I mean, one thing that's happened here now is with the where we are now is that there is no middle of the roads. I mean, you either for what is right and good for people as a whole is and a model for the world, or you're not.
You left college in 1961 to join the civil rights movement. How did you make that decision?
It was a difficult decision for me because I'm a product of a sharecropper's family. I was raised on a plantation farm outside of Shreveport, Louisiana. And when I went to school, I finished high school. I was the first one in my family to finish high school. So going to college was a big move. I mean, and I wanted to become an electrical engineer. And so I didn't want to have anything to do with the civil rights movement, not because I didn't care, it's because the fact is that I felt that here's my opportunity to move forward in the country. And I sort of just got caught up in things. And so in getting the civil rights movement, it's almost like fate. I've just got caught up in it. I was in a one day I was walking across campus of Dillard University, which is a historic black college in New Orleans, and there was a rally on campuses. A young lady was speaking, you know, and she was very attractive, so I decided I wanted to talk to her, and she was talking about the civil rights movement piece. And our first date to talk to was to take me to a CORE meeting in New Orleans, and there, from there, went in on a sit-in, and from there, joined the Freedom Rocks. And so it was all it had to do with the fact is of just being in the wrong place. There's a lot of connection to how that happened. But then the really turning point was, I guess, was the Freedom Rocks. I mean, went on the Freedom Rocks. I was really caught up into the emotional piece, and I ended up in Montgomery on the night when the riots were going on there, and the Klans and others were attacking the church and other in Montgomery, and we were the next day, and so it was Dr. King and a bunch of us. And the decision is trying to be made in terms of whether the riots should continue, and some of the elders were saying we should not continue the riots. And it wasn't because they were afraid; it was more because of the fact is they were concerned about the welfare of the young people. And so I was there as one of the young people, and Diane Nash, James Bellow, and a group of the CORE people from the New Orleans CORE group, Jerome Smith, Doris Castle, who was the young lady who was speaking that I was talking about earlier, and one of the Thompson sisters. And I was sitting there, and so when I talk about fate, it was and it's fate and faith here. And so trying to make that decision, and I was really torn because if I go on this ride, I probably would not finish school. And the fact is, I am now in a situation is whereby I was sure that anyone who got on that bus, they were going to die. I mean, I think everybody in that room felt very strongly about that because of all the activities that were going on outside and reports we were getting in, and the Klansmen saying they were going to, no bus was going to make it into Mississippi. Well, in that room, I suddenly heard a voice, and I don't know who said it. It had to be someone in that room, but I've not been able to find out who that was. But what I heard was that there's not enough space in this room for both fear and God. And he said, make your choice. And so at that particular point, it was almost like, you know, getting some surge. It was like nothing else mattered. You know, this is God's work in the senses. And so that's where I went. And so from that point on, there was no turning back, and I volunteered to be on the first bus, and I've been volunteering ever since then. And so I'm not sure as to, a lot of people ask me the question is, what caused you to do it? And what is it going to take? And I want to be involved. What do you think I should do? I can't tell them that is. It's sort of you have to have the feeling and a commitment. And that's what I think a lot of the people had at that time. And what we need now is a resurgence of that type of commitment for change as the young people had in the 60s and stuff. And the other piece that is lacking is the family structure. And I'm not talking about biological family. One of the things that we had then, the people, both black people, and a lot of people as a whole, was strong family ties. And it wasn't just biological. I came up as a single parent, from a single parent to home. But I had a lot of daddies because we had real communities then. And since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, is we don't have those communities. They don't exist anymore. There are places where these young people live and poor people live, and they don't have any resources to have, be a true community. There aren't any parks. There aren't any places, recreational places. It's a place whereby infestation of violence and others, because there is another way, a place to turn, and the country has more or less turned their backs on. And seeing to me is that was an intentional act after the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Because what happened is country was put into places that put into place things, activities, and programs that really attacked the basic structure of the black community. At that time is you could get people to be very concerned about issues and march and demonstrate and if something happened in their communities. And so the idea was how you get to the fibers. So it went after the culture. You had the Monaghan report that blamed black people for the dysfunction of families, because the fact is that you talk about people come from single homes. Well, you know, that's how we were brought here. I mean, as slaves, and the first thing they did, slave owners did, was to separate the parents. So we had a strong bond, and that is which we call community or extended family. And so I had a lot of fathers, Mr. Jack, Mr. Brown, and others. If I did something wrong, you know, they caught me on and they chastised me for it. And a lot of mothers who did that is. So we just weren't, we were children of the community. And we don't have that in this country anymore. And so we need to figure out a way is whereby we look at it in education. We have to be concerned not just about our own biological child, but we have to be concerned about all the children because they are children of the country. So I think that's one of the issues we have to deal with in terms of how do you change. When you talk about make America great again, we have to think about what we're talking about.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with David Dennis, a leader during the 1960s civil rights movement and the featured speaker at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration in La Crosse. David, you spoke about having to make that decision between taking a more active role in the civil rights movement and, you know, following your personal pursuits in college. And I wonder if you feel like young people today are facing similar questions, similar dilemmas about whether to speak up or take a more active role, or whether to just, you know, keep their head down and focus on their personal pursuits?
Well, yeah, I think they are. I think the issues are a little bit different. I think one of the obstacles to their dealing with them are a little bit different. And it's hard to put your finger on it. And in those days, segregation sort of slapped you in the face. You colored on his signs and you can't go here, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it was right there, dead in your face. But one of the things we had was people got to know each other a little bit better. You know, I think there were the cultural differences and other things, but we got to know. And the reason being is we spent more time. Families spent more time with each other. Now kids sit at a table, they walk with their heads down, they don't even see each other anymore. They're looking at these little technology. Cell phones and other texting and things of that nature. People don't have personal conversation. Most of us at a distance. And so the whole world has changed to a large extent. We used to be able to sit and have dinner together and talk with each other, whether or not you're biological family, or neighbors, whatever you have is. We don't do that anymore. It's all in front of a TV set. It's all in front of iPads and what we have is, and so there's a lack of conversation, and so there's not conversation in the classroom. So teachers are not, really developing personal relationships. Teachers don't know a lot of the students, especially students working from the bottom quartile of poor students, because they don't even live in the same communities anymore. So we don't have this disconnected. So you have people coming in, have no idea of who they're coming in contact with, and saying they're going to try to teach them, without understanding who they're trying to teach. So therefore, is the whole communication gap between human beings and people today is much, much different than it was then. So in some way, through all this maze of problems and issues, in addition to the prejudices that exist in the country today and the world, we've got to figure out how to bridge this gap. I mean, how do young people communicate not only with each other, but with the adults? How do we begin to bridge this particular gap? And that's not an easy question, because it's something that's moving through the institutions, that deal with people, even the churches. I mean, most of the churches now have moved out of poor communities, and now they're called mega churches and exist on the outside of it. So you don't even have that, the basic for places where these kids, young people live in. So how you do this, we've got to figure this out, because it's not on this country, but the world is depending upon whether or not human beings can begin to deal with each other, as human beings. So when you say make America great again, at one time as part of the people, not considered to be whole human beings. So are we talking about moving back to that? And so this whole technology and everything else we have, is not saying you can get rid of technology. The question is how we can begin to frame, minds and so that we don't let technology control us, but we figure out how we can control technology to the betterment of man.
You were arrested over 30 times while helping to register disenfranchised voters during the civil rights movement. And I wonder what your thoughts are on Americans' ability to vote today. Do you think we see the same numbers of disenfranchised voters today?
Yes, I think, and it's a little bit different. I mean, the disenfranchisement is in the 60s is people were actually killed for trying to get people to register voters. They were actually killed and murdered attempted to register vote themselves. During the 60s, when I was working in Mississippi and Louisiana, we lost over 19 people. You only hear about a few. Medgar Evers, I was with him, just a couple of hours before he was killed. And Cheney Goodman Swerner, I was with them, the night before they were killed. And so I knew people who were, involved in the movement and, who died and things, in their efforts to get people registered to vote the fact is to register to vote themselves. So today is a little bit different, the disenfranchisement. It comes in another forms, and you have it whereby trumped up charges on people is, and you know, there is, you know, the felony charges and going to jail. I mean, you got large numbers of, we have the largest population of incarcerated people in the world is in the United States of America. And we have that, and then the whole piece of people just being, when you do register to vote, is to question a lot of people can have no, why vote? I mean, so the dilution of the power of that existing, you know, is happening every day. So you're looking at elections, I mean, now, Florida, Georgia, you know, I mean, it's quite obvious of things that are going on that's not right, and that is why people's votes are not being counted in North Carolina. Then you got the whole issue of whether or not foreign countries are beginning to hack into the voter registration pieces. So people begin to say, what the hell, why? You know, so the disenfranchisement is coming on a whole different way. It's, you know, it's a whole psychological piece, a lot of it is. And so we've got to figure this out because, I mean, at the present time is, what does it mean to rule? And now you got the whole issue, just party. You have people suffering now because in the country is shut down almost is because parties, you know, Democratic, Republican parties, all about the party. Well, nobody's talking about what is right about the people. You know, when we talk about we the people, who are the people? So I think that the, you know, the disenfranchisement is different. It's more subtle, but it's also just as deadly. And so people need to have some wake-up call. And I think, though, we begin to see more young people really begin to raise the question. I mean, they are going to have to begin to make a demand and a change in this country. And so when I look at the work of HBCUs, there is the David Goodman, the Andrew Goodman Foundation is doing a lot of work with the college students about voter registration and voter education. And I've watched students in the past elections, like in New Orleans, you know, not only register to vote, but marching into the in the rain and all the cast their votes. And then, you know, I see, I think there's beginning to be, there's becoming a, some type of an awakening of young people begin to raise the question about what's going on.
Yeah, what advice do you have for the next generation of, you know, community leaders fighting for civil rights?
Well, I think they need to raise the question. And so the issue is not just complaining. I mean, the powers to be is that the what's happening is at the local level. That's where the organizing needs to happen. So we should be running people for everything from dog catcher on up is. And we need to also be more concerned about it, not just looking in from the outside. We need to be attending every school board meeting, every city council meeting. And I'm not just talking about adults. I'm talking about students. Students from the universities and students from the high schools, the middle schools, everything that's happening out there is impacting their lives. So they need to be present, and they should be demanding that the local officials, the elected officials, begin to respond to their needs. And so one of the things, ways they need to do is just as been doing with some of the young people around the gun control pieces. We need to begin to organize at the local level is, and the young people begin to make a demand upon the system and upon the leadership. So that's one of the things we can do. I mean, from the churches on in, you know, wherever young people have as an audience, have an opportunity to raise an audience, they should begin to organize at the local level is. I mean, I don't care if it's just for trying to get a park, to clean a place for them to play and have fun. Even just to a recreational place. I mean, they need to begin to make the demand of the local officials to be able to put in place those things that they need in order to be citizens.
Activist and retired attorney David Dennis Sr. is here with us today ahead of his appearance at La Crosse's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. Coming up, we'll hear from past recipients of La Crosse's Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award about how the honor has influenced their lives. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're previewing La Crosse's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. Part of the event includes recognizing a community member who's worked to continue Dr. King's work here in the La Crosse area. The Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award was created in 2009 to recognize a local leader who's fighting racism and other social injustices and building a more inclusive community. Joining us today are some of the past award recipients. They'll share how they've been working to better the community and how receiving the award has influenced their life. We're here with Thomas Harris, 2010 award winner and assistant director of the Office of Multicultural Student Services at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Andrea Hansen, 2011 award winner and director of UWL's Self-Sufficiency Program. And Nate Coleman, 2018 award winner and founder of the Good Fight Community Center in La Crosse. So Thomas, could you start by talking a little bit about, you know, how this award got started?
Myself, Curtis Miller, a couple of other folks in the community were looking for a way for individuals or organizations, really entities that were taking action to support social justice, breaking down systematic issues of racism and bigotry and discrimination. We recognize organizations and people when they make a lot of money or able to fundraise and bring out a lot of monies. We recognize people when they get degrees and they go on and get their education and they're successful in what they do. We just thought that there was a need that needed to be taken care of in our community. So it really, really started, I think it was with Amos during that time, where Curtis was the main leader. And they took it upon themselves to create this award where it could actually be center stage awarded on the stage of the Martin Luther King Community Holiday Celebration here in La Crosse. So since 2009, we've had a recipient, me being the second, and that's really how it started. And it's we utilize the former recipients to actually take part and do the review and actually artist selection committee. But anybody can actually submit.
Yeah, and I wonder, Andrea, maybe you can jump in on what you guys look for when you're looking for the next award winner.
Well, we have set out in our application and our publicity some of the key things that we're looking for from nominees. And part of it is just a continuation of Dr. Martin Luther King's work. And that's work that is really about community empowerment. It's about anti-racism work. It's about justice. It's about justice that includes economic and gender justice as well, a commitment to principles of anti-violence, and a way in which you extend beyond your professional involvements to really be grounded in the community. We're also looking at people who build bridges and relationships throughout the community, and particularly with communities of color and others doing the work of justice making in public. So those are some of the things that we look for.
And so each of you are an award winner, as I mentioned. And so, you know, Nate, I wonder if you could start us off by sharing a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing in the La Crosse community that kind of led to you being the 2018 award winner.
In August of 2016, I founded the Good Fight Community Center with the idea that there were kids who were sort of missing the mark and sliding through the holes. They didn't exactly fit at other organizations, and I wanted an after-school program that would include all kids, that would bring even the kids that were struggling in other after-school programs. So the Good Fight Community Center looks to help kids who are economically challenged, who are educationally challenged, It doesn't matter what color they are, black, white, green, yellow, orange, and bring them together in a place that's safe. We have a boxing program that is mostly for physical fitness and to teach kids that they have to be tough and tough to get through life. We have a mentorship program. We have a tutoring program. We help kids to get better grades in school through an ACT prep program. We help them to get into college. We help them with college applications. We help them with job applications. If they want to get into the military, we walk them through that process. We have a small library that we've started. Kids can read and write book reports, and we give them prizes for doing book reports. We've just recently opened an art and music center where we have volunteers teaching art, both painting and drawing, and then music. We have guitars that were donated locally, and so kids can learn to play guitars. And, you know, the tough kid who's out on the street doing something may not realize he has a talent to play guitar or a talent to draw or a talent to. So we open up all these avenues for kids that may not be able to do this because in today's economic situation, it might be considered something extra to have to get a music lesson or art lesson. We just offer it at our center.
What do you think the community has gained from having this space for kids in our community?
I think every time someone takes a step to make a community better, anybody, from the smallest step, it brings people in, whether it's they decide that they want to volunteer because they see something that touches their heart, or they remember a teacher or a mentor or someone at a church organization, whatever, that brought them in and helped them. So it brings back memories of what a good community looks like and what a helpful community looks like. And it doesn't matter if it's my kid or your kid, it's a kid that needs help. And so I think just every time somebody opens an organization or does something like this, it not only helps the kids, it inspires other people to decide that they need to be a part of it. You can't just stand around if you see something good happening. You get a good feeling by doing something good, and so it just sort of draws you in.
What have you personally gained from doing this work?
Oh, my gosh. It has been completely amazing at watching the transformation of kids who come in with one attitude and believing one thing and then leaving with another attitude. I had a young man who stopped in Saturday when we were open, and he's in college, and we had a long discussion about he wasn't sure if he's going to be able to go to college, and he gave me all the reasons why he couldn't, and now he's working on an engineering degree. So to go from, I don't think I can, I don't know what I'm going to do, I'm probably going to spend the rest of my life, you know, working somewhere, it's like, no, you can do whatever you can do. And so it feels good to see the results when you inspire somebody to do something that you know they can't do, but they haven't been far enough down the trail to know that they can do it. And that's what The Good Fight is all about, teaching kids to fight the good fight, to find their best selves and apply themselves to that and win, you know.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with past recipients of the Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award ahead of this year's community celebration. We're here with Nate Coleman, the 2018 winner, Thomas Harris, the 2010 winner, and Andrea Hansen, the 2011 winner. Andrea, we'll go to you next and have you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the work you've done in the La Crosse community that kind of led to you being recognized with this award.
I think because I was positioned within the continuing ed and extension, it brought me into the community in ways that helped me, one, provide support for community initiatives, but also I was able to instigate some as well and have figured out how to continue those involvements without kind of outside of my professional involvement. So let me give you an example. I believe that the work that I did with the diversity initiatives, and particularly within the workplace, that was something that I was able to get some funding for through my work with Continuing Ed and Extension, a small grant. But because when the grant ended, people who were coming together from a variety of workplaces and work sectors, they didn't want to stop meeting to work on developing relationships, being supportive of each other, of all the things that people can do within workplaces to be inclusive, to be welcoming, to work on retention, and to be really critical about the ways in which our organizations may be closed to new voices or voices that are not recognized as important. And so that's the work, I believe, that brought me to the award. And that was really touching in a lot of ways, because I see that work was done in a group and in a collaborative. And it continued because people did not want it to stop there. And so now the Diversity Council is in its, I can't even do the math, but it's still alive. We've been able to hire part-time directors. We have some really wonderful memberships, and we've fallen into the ways that communities can bring change within the workplace that can inspire and help people remember what creates barriers and borders that can be very discouraging for underrepresented groups. So I was humbled in a lot of ways. That sounds kind of a cliche to say you're humbled by an award, but it really, the work I understand myself is that you work in concert with others to make change, because that's what's required. The other thing that I've done is, I mean, I come from the background of women's studies and sociology and community work and justice work and anti-poverty work and all that. And if you do your work, your paid work, with those kinds of principles in mind, you're going to do it a little differently and involve people differently. So my community work also included work with a Hispanic Resource Center in my home community of Sparta, and then also a long-term care workforce coalition, knowing that women are overrepresented in that workforce, and particularly women of color in that workforce. So those were really specific economic ideas and realities that I felt like were important to do. So I think that's kind of those are the kinds of involvements that brought my name up to the nominating committee. And I was very grateful and humbled and also encouraged. And I guess that's the effect of an award or recognition, is kind of like, well, just keep going. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, what you feel like you've gained from doing this work, from taking part in, you know, in bettering the community in this way.
Well, certainly the relationships with and the examples of my colleagues within communities, as well as within, you know, my work life, that has been very enriching. And to understand that people are kind of in larger organizations and small organizations working sometimes in isolation to address the difficult conversations, to ask the hard questions, to reach out and support others that are working with the principles of anti-racism and inclusion and democracy and justice in mind. And that makes a difference. And it can be isolating. So a chance to know that people are doing what they can and stretching themselves, that's been very inspiring, and I feel pleased to be part of that. So for me, it's an encouragement. I can just think of many people who don't give up and can keep the large conversations in mind. And also being patient with the rate of change, because being transformative within an organization, let alone a community, is a tall order.
And Thomas, you were the 2010 award winner. And you know, I wonder if you could just share a little bit about some of the work you've done.
Right around that time, 2008 through 2010, I think there were two or three things happening simultaneously. One was in 2007, I think, the Diversity Council was established and created. That's when I was born. I was a part of that with Andrea. And then in 2005, the Martin Luther King community event was taken or shifted from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse to be a community event where anybody could be on that committee from the community, as opposed to it being just a UWL event. In both situations, we're talking about collaboration, partnerships with different people working for really the community. And then the third thing that was happening, that we started taking people to the National White Privilege Conference. And then in 2010, we ended up being the host city for the National White Privilege Conference. And again, that involved collaboration with businesses, organizations, the political entities, and everyone, education, K through 12, the colleges, the universities, and so on, WTC. So we really didn't do that kind of collaboration, I don't think, until during that time. And to me, that's been the time when that started that, where it's continued all the way into other parts of organizing in the community and in the region. So we had about 1,700 people come to the National White Privilege Conference from all across the United States. It was, at that time, it had increased probably maybe 400 people from the highest number that had attended prior. Right now, it's probably 2,500 people, 2,800 people, depending on where it is. I'm now a board member of what's called the Privilege Institute, which oversees that conference and some other entities. 2 years ago, they established, I'm talking about TPI, the Privilege Institute, they established a weekend event called the White Privilege Symposium, which we're right now currently looking at possibly bringing to La Crosse in 2020. We're going to be using a book called, it's by Debbie Irving, Waking Up White. We're going to do a book read, a community book read, a regional book read. The library is already invested in this, starting with 100 free books that's going to be out there, and there will be more. And we're hoping as many people as possible can read it. And the idea is to bring Debbie to be one of the keynotes for that symposium in 2020. But I really think that what we're really talking about here is to have some kind of education or some kind of knowledge about diversity, common sense knowledge, as well as book knowledge and what's going on in our community and outside of our community and even nationwide, and utilizing those resources that are around us to make us better and to make us more insightful on what the differences are in our community and how we can maximize to make those differences a positive thing for our community and to help help the people in our community understand there's a positive in everything. You can find something in everyone that's positive. You probably can find something negative too, but you don't need to focus on that all the time. And I also think it has to do with equity. And what I mean by equity is what do we really, really need, and what do people need, and what do specific communities need, what the LGBT community might be very different than what the African-American community needs that's straight. So I think there's times when we do things together and we do things across the board, but I also think that there's a necessity for white people just to spend time learning what does it mean to be white, because I had to learn what it meant to be a black man even as a kid. I had mentors who said, you need to do this and not to do this and to watch this, you know, when I grew up in the inner city of Milwaukee. So I think we're really talking about preparing our community for the future, knowing that it's going to become more diverse economically, with the types of people and where people come from, and how to be respectful, and how to not make judgment, but give people chances and opportunities, listen to their opinions, listen to their voice.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with past recipients of the Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award ahead of this year's community celebration. We're here with Thomas Harris, the 2010 award winner, Andrea Hansen, the 2011 winner, and Nate Coleman, the 2018 winner. Thomas, you started to touch on, you know, what the La Crosse community needs to continue to focus on as, you know, we work to become a more inclusive and just community. And, you know, Nate, I wonder what your thoughts are on as, you know, people continue to try to do this work, many in the spirit of Dr. King. You know, what does La Crosse need to continue this fight?
From my experience, from opening the community center, I have seen an outpouring of support from this community. And I guess as long as there continues to be community involvement, I think that we will be okay as a community. I have gotten responses and donations and ideas from places that I wouldn't have thought of. Small businesses have called me and said, hey, I've got this. Do you think this would be something the kids would be interested in? I don't know. Let's try it. Let's find out. I've had people walk in and say, hey, I used to, you know, box back in the 50s. Is it okay if I come in and maybe just look at it and see? You know, people find their place when they find a reason and a way to care. I had a volunteer who's still there with me. His wife had passed away. And he was wearing an Everlast shirt, which is a boxing company. And I asked him if he used to box, and he said, yeah. So I asked him if he'd like to come and volunteer maybe a day a week. Well, now he's there 5 days a week volunteering. He was having a conversation with a kid who was 14, and I didn't understand the conversation. So, you know, being a director, I tapped him on the shoulder and said, what are you guys talking about? He goes, oh, well, the Marvel comic, this guy was this superhero that did this and that. And I'm looking at him like, wait, what? You know, I know nothing about it. But here's a 60-something-year-old guy who has now made a contact with a 14-year-old kid. They're both different races, but they both like Marvel Comics. They found a common ground. That's what success in a community looks like. Finding a place where, you know, someone who's one color and one age and another color and another age can find something ridiculous to talk about and be okay with each other and learn from each other and grow and find out that they're okay. I think that's really important.
You know, Andre, earlier you brought up the idea of collaboration being at the center of a lot of the work and the change that you've seen in the community. And I wonder what your thoughts are on, you know, how the La Crosse community is doing now on collaboration. You know, are we improving things by working together?
La Crosse is lively, and they're wonderful individuals and resources. We're not short on ideas. We have a capacity issue in terms of we're small and in terms of population. And so there's that, and we're not the wealthiest community at all. And we struggle with, you know, childhood poverty and suppressed wages and things that are really pressing on people. So, but the collaboration is the thing, I think, and the relationships help everyone feel like there's an avenue to be involved, to keep being inspired and hopeful, to continue our creative work together. It's really such a resource to have three institutions of higher ed here, and that's really strong, and the strong sense of, you know, Wisconsin, you know, the Wisconsin idea reaching the, you know, all the boundaries of the states and making a big difference. And we have quite a lot of heritage that lines us up to have good things happen. And so as far as, you know, are we making a difference? I believe we are. And even at the very basic level, there's always someone that will be inspiring and hopeful and inviting to be involved within the community as a whole. So I guess that's a real generic way of thinking about it, but I think we're making a difference because people are stepping forward and being involved.
That's Andrea Hansen, director of UWL's Self-Sufficiency Program, here with us today to talk about La Crosse's Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award, which she won in 2011. She's joined by other past recipients of the award, Thomas Harris, assistant director of the Office of Multicultural Student Services at UWL, and the 2010 winner, and the 2018 winner, Nate Coleman, founder of the Good Fight Community Center in La Crosse. The winner this year of the Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award is Shondell Spivey. He'll receive the award at the annual celebration on Monday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Viterbo Fine Arts Center. And that's Newsbankers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview with this year's keynote speaker at the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.